The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. Eric Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Folks, this is the Eric Metaxas Show. You know how much I love the subject of science, and I've become enamored of the Discovery Institute because they seem to publish books that I find fascinating. Recently, I got one in the mail from the Discovery Institute. The title is Taking Leave of Darwin. The author is Neil Thomas, and I was particularly enjoying the book when I got the idea that what if I could have Neil Thomas on this program and we could all enjoy a conversation with him. I have him now from merry old England, actually from Reading, England, near London. Neil Thomas, welcome to this program.
Thanks for having me.
I loved your book. I love the way you write. I love the subject, of course. I'm fascinated with natural selection, the idea of it, and what science is revealing more and more, and what we're hearing about very little, but more and more through folks like you and the Discovery Institute. So if you don't mind, tell my audience, before you came to the subject, what is it that you do? You're really an eclectic thinker. You've written on Wagner's operas. What do you do when you're not thinking about the subject of Darwin?
Well, I am a retired academic, and my subject was German language literature and European literature in a wider context. So I retired some 12 years ago, and since then I've been essentially sort of starting a second life. I had a little bit of commercial experience in the world. I've got a portfolio of rental properties and so on. I thought it was important to diversify a bit from the academic life. In fact, I never thought I would write another book until I was impelled to do so by finding out what I thought were the deficiencies of Darwinism. Yeah.
So what led you, I mean, to be a professor on German language and literature? I know you've written on the, how's it pronounced?
Nibelungenlied.
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 Yes. Yeah. Who hasn't written a book on the Nibelungenlied? I haven't.
The Song of the Nibelungen,
The Nibelungen. Mm-hmm. And you, what led you from the subject of German language and literature into Darwinism?
It's totally unexpected and very surprising. I swore blue blind to my wife that I would never write another word because I thought it was more important to diversify my life a bit. But I think that I found that I was getting dissatisfied with what was being put out as the party line on Darwinism. And I do remember when I was in post 20 years ago, an Oxford literature academic using the word memes to refer to cultural influences. And I thought, why on earth would you use the word memes when the word cultural influence or osmosis or whatever you like might do justice to it? And it seemed to me we had enough pretentious stuff anyway in literary criticism. And I thought, well, why import stuff from the biological realm? But more viscerally than that, I think in the last few years, I can't remember when, but I had a kind of, I woke up with a kind of shock, like you do when you're falling. You have this feeling of falling in your sleep. I thought, This Darwinism can't be right. Everything must have a first cause, whether you call it God or a cosmic principle or whatever. And I began to reframe my understanding of Darwinism in the light of that dream.
In the light of what? I missed that.
In the light of the dream that I had of a panic, that I felt that something in this life must have a first cause. It must have a creator. You can't have an effect without a cause, in good logic.
Well, that I mean, the creation of life takes us into what they call abiogenesis, which really has nothing to do with Darwinism. But once you get life, and we can assume the first cell, obviously Darwin and his followers have said natural selection is what moves us along. When did this begin to fall apart for you? Because you're not a biologist.
I'm certainly not.
And you're not somebody that comes at this from a religious point of view. You're simply a thinker, and you follow the logic. But were you surprised to find yourself looking into this subject?
Very surprised, because I've been a lifelong member of the British Rationalist Association. Which usually takes a stance against any theistic interpretation of events, and so I was surprised to find myself thinking in these ways. But I mean, I don't feel that the term natural selection is a very intellectually coherent one. In fact, one of the things I'm doing, I'm doing a sort of follow-up book at the moment. And one of the things I've looked at is the way that Darwin's Origin of Species was translated into German. And the German translators had enormous difficulties with the term natural selection, because Darwin insisted to the translators that you must render it in some way as to suggest that there's no aim or telos in the process. And The translators just couldn't really work out where he was coming from. How can you have selection without a conscious aim? It's just incoherent. So I felt that this was perhaps my starting point. You know, the simple logic is against it.
Now I agree with everything you see in your book, but that point is difficult for me to get. In other words, it seems that the term natural selection is a poor term, because it suggests a telos. It suggests that nature is trying to do something, when, of course, Darwin's idea is that it's blind, that it is simply, in retrospect, it looks as though it has been selecting. In other words, the genes that are selected, that survival of the fittest, in retrospect, they appear to have been selected, but so it's a clumsy term. But the idea never troubled me. In other words, the idea that a giraffe with a longer neck might be more suited to life, and that those longer necked giraffes would succeed, whereas the shorter giraffes wouldn't. In other words, that idea never troubled me. But are you saying that idea itself bothered you?
Well, that amongst other things. I mean, the point is that how many millions of years did it take, according to Darwin, to get to evolve a longer neck? Many, many multi-millions, I would suggest. I mean, given that the giraffe might have started off with a short neck, wouldn't it have been better to follow the migratory patterns of birds and other animals and simply forage for food where it was more convenient, as opposed to waiting millions of years for the neck to elongate by natural selection? I mean, I'm not the first person to have made that point.
Yeah,
but I mean, it does seem as cogent one.
Of course, it also makes us wonder why there aren't innumerable animals with extremely long giraffe-like necks. Why only...
Very much so, yes. This was pointed out many years ago, in the middle of the last century. Why aren't ostriches able to fly? And why aren't some animals able to swim, since it would be an advantage? And so I do feel that this selective business about giraffes, I mean, it, as you say, it could apply to other animals, but doesn't.
We're going to go to a break here since we're doing radio for much of our audience.
Yeah.
I really love this book, Taking Leave of Darwin. Folks, we'll be right back with the author.
Hey folks, are you concerned about memory loss for you or a loved one? VivaLore's founder prayed that God would show her the solution to memory loss because her mother had dementia. After many divine encounters combining faith and her background as a pharmacist, Susan Gibson created VivaLore Memory Support. VivaLore is a premium quality all-natural supplement with 5 to 20 times more nutrients than any other memory supplement. It won awards and has 3 books independently written about it. Visit VivaLore.com for testimonials about the life-changing improvements people have experienced. VivaLore is for those with normal memory, mild or severe memory loss. Don't wait until your memory slips. The pathology starts 20 years before your first memory loss symptom. That's VivaLore, VivaLore.com. Check it out. Remember, VivaLore is a premium quality all-natural supplement with 5 to 20 times more nutrients than any other memory supplement. VivaLore is V-I-V-O-L-O-R at VivaLore.com. Enter promo code 20 for 20% off. VivaLore.com, V-I-V-O-L-O-R.com.
Hey there, folks. How many years have I been telling you about Relief Factor? What, like 4? The truth is, I know there are millions of people, in fact, some say over 100 million people struggling with some kind of pain, maybe from exercise, just getting older. That could do it, getting older, which is why I am so impressed with Pete and Seth Talbot. They are on a mission. You rarely see this kind of focus and commitment. Seriously, they recently shared with me that they are doubling down and want to literally double their total number of happy customers in the next year. And I believe they'll do it. So here's the deal. If you're struggling with back, neck, shoulder, hip, or knee pain, even general muscle aches and pains, then I'm suggesting you order their 3-week quick start, still discounted to only $19.95, about a dollar a day, to see if we can get you out of pain too. And then after that, less than the cost of a cup of coffee a day to stay out of pain. Go to relieffactor.com, relieffactor.com, or call 800-500-8384, relieffactor.com, 800-500-8384. I use it. It works. I'm talking to the author of a new book, a terrific book. It's called Taking Leave of Darwin. The author is my guest, Neil Thomas. Neil Thomas, you said earlier that you started out, you're an academic writing on the subject of German languages and literature and other European literature. Now you found yourself leaping into the world of Darwin. And you said that you were a member of the British Rationalist Association. Is that what it's called?
Yes. Yes.
So I assume that you and your colleagues there are mostly either agnostics or atheists and not people of Christian faith.
Yes. I would have described myself as an agnostic. I'm wavering at the moment as a result of my findings. But yes, okay. So, yes, that's so true enough.
So you don't come to the subject from the point of view of faith. You just come to it as a free thinker, as it were. Do you find, as you get into the subject, that Darwin is so generally accepted in the world, in the academy, that anybody who questions him immediately becomes, looked at in a strange way? Or didn't you care about that?
It doesn't affect me, since I am now a retiree of independent means. You know, it really is irrelevant to me. But I do understand that people in the biological world of academia are threatened by all sorts of things, including dismissal. I have heard on the grapevine if they fall out of line with Darwin's thinking. Yes, I have heard about that. But in more so, I think that no, I'm not a person of faith, but my wife is, and I've got many friends who are people of faith, and I do feel bad for them because I feel that in a way, this whole Darwinian bandwagon has tended to rob them of their spiritual birthright, to imply that their own instincts are wrong, that they should forsake any theistic interpretations, any idea of God. And I think that's wrong. And I do, and I was rather scandalized to realize that the Anglican Church back in 2008 had made a public apology to Darwin. Well, I think that's complete nonsense, because I don't think that Darwin is a proven theory at all.
Well, we know that many mainline churches, in particular the Anglican Church, they're not exactly known for their cultural bravery. But I guess I'm curious about your process. In other words, as you began to look into this, what were some of the arguments against Darwinism, or what was it that was occurring to you as you looked into this?
Well, one of the things, I looked at the Origin of Species, and I looked at Descent of Man, which is a sort of pendant companion volume to it. And the way that Darwin argues and uses language is A, very amateurish and impressionistic, and B, it's very wheedling and tries to get at you in the way that advertising does or political propaganda does. He gives everything a spin or a gloss. And I interpret that as being very suspicious, because it implies that he's not really sure of his fact. He's trying to pull the wool over our eyes and push one over on us. I did use my sort of training, for many decades to try and unmask what I thought was some of the false pretensions of his writing.
It's fascinating to hear you say this, because that's the one thing typically that you don't hear. In other words, people looking at him, not just as a scientist, but as a writer, as a persuader. And you did, I don't know if you used the term in England, but we say, that he's putting English on the ball, in billiards, that he's basically trying, rather than simply presenting the facts, he's making an argument that the lay reader maybe wouldn't notice that he's doing that.
Yes, I think so. I mean, in many ways, he was a very decent individual, but he had his faults. And I think that he wasn't straight with his audience or his readership. And also he was quite rather equivocating in his own mind. He didn't sometimes know his own mind. I mean, you've got to remember that Darwin, despite his being feted by posterity, was a rather average schoolboy, to say the least. And it, sort of conceptual clarity was not one of his great strengths, it seems to me. And people tend to praise him to the rooftops as if he were some sort of Einstein figure, but that was not the case. And to be fair to him, in his autobiography, he admits as much. He says, "I'm not as bright as my sister," for instance. And his father thought of him as rather... which is tremendous. I mean, I like that kind of refreshing candor.
What are some of the arguments as you go through, if somebody goes through the book Taking Leave of Darwin, which I enjoyed immensely, I think in large part because of your own writing style, it's very engaging. But so what are some of the arguments against Darwinism, or what are some of the things that you notice that people will find in the book?
Well, the evidence, I suppose, is that there is no empirical backup for his claims. There is no empirical backup of a hybridization of animals modulating from one animal into another. And remember, Darwin's theory is not just a few biological tack-ons. He's suggesting that you and I developed ultimately from bacterial beings. And to accept that, one would need a little bit more proof, I think.
Well, and so you're saying that the transitional forms are not in evidence in the fossil record. Is that what you mean, principally?
They are not in evidence. And Darwin, to his credit, says in The Origin of Species, nature should, if I were right, be in a state of uproar. We should have, dogs that look half like cats and cats that look half like horses, but nothing of the sort exists. And also, nothing of the sort exists in the fossil record either. I mean, Darwin piously hoped that the fossil record would redeem his reputation in the century and a half that we've had since he wrote the book and so on. But that has not been the case. The fossil record is most Darwinian, if you might put it like that. Animals come to be as a result. They seem to be fully formed. It's as if creation had created them individually. And I have to say that, I'm surprising myself, but I have to say that because that is where the scientific evidence points to from the so-called Cambrian explosion of animal life 540 million years ago. There are no transitional forms.
So what do you think, what do the proponents of blind Darwinism, so-called, what did they say about this, for my audience's sake, tell us? Because isn't an astonishing thing. Most of us are led to believe in school that this is settled, that the evidence is there. When I talk to certain scientific friends, they're aghast that I wouldn't have accepted this. But you're saying that the record is increasingly clear that there are not transitional forms, and we mean between species. In other words, we can find finches with different beaks. We can find what's called microevolution, but macroevolution in all these decades and now a century and a half, there's nothing. So what do proponents of this say in answer to that question?
To be candid, there is no convincing straight answer to this. I mean, the proponents of Darwinism have to consider, or they wish to consider, that this problem must be solved on a purely naturalistic level. We cannot invoke any superior or higher forces. And so what they say is, oh, well, maybe it's an imperfect theory, but it's the best we've got so far. And that is supposed to absolve all faults in the theory itself, which I don't think it does. I think it's a matter of biologists marking their own homework. I am not a biologist. As I said to a neighbor of mine, when she said, oh, I didn't know you were an expert on Darwin. I don't think I'm an expert, I said. I think I'm a member of a jury who has been asked to adjudicate on a very technical case. And I've done my level best to master the material in order to be able to provide answers. And my dispassionate, because I've got no skin in the game really, answer is that Darwinism does not stack up logically. It will not fly. And a number of Darwin's own peers, scientific peers, not people like myself from the arts and humanities, scientific peers felt the same. They felt that some kind of theistic evolution would have been necessary. Something must be driving.
For a moment, we're going to go to another break. Folks, I'm talking to the author, Taking Leave of Darwin. Do not go away. I'm talking to Neil Thomas, the author of a terrific volume. It's called Taking Leave of Darwin. Neil Thomas, just continue the point you were making. Very important.
Well, that Darwin, if you look at the sepia-tinted photographs of Darwin, you see him as a rather severe Victorian gentleman that you would have to watch your P's and Q's with. In reality, he seems to have been a very sociable, clubbable person. He seems to have inspired, and I don't use this word lightly, but he inspired a lot of brotherly love from his surrounding peers. And I feel that they did not want to tread on his toes by saying, we think your theory of natural selection will not fly. They try to trim their responses to him because they loved him in a fraternal sense, and they wanted to help him. And this is surprising. I wish I could inspire so much love as Charles Darwin. It would help me a lot socially and professionally in my life. But anyway, he to an extraordinary extent, he made people sort of blunt their attacks on him because he was such a charming fellow, I think.
So you think that, I mean, in the book, you say, beware, you've been fooled. In other words, that Darwin, through his social graces and through the way he wrote, he basically, as I think you said, dulled the criticisms and enabled this theory, which, as far as you're concerned, has no actual scientific backing, enabled it to go forward through the decades so that those opposed to some theistic solution grabbed it and said, we have to make this work, even though it has problems, there's nothing better. And then you say that, what does it matter whether there's anything better, either this works or doesn't? And you say on the facts, it simply does not.
Yes, I think it doesn't. I think it's a number of people have said that it's a sort of etiquette of biological research that you have to be able to put up an opposing theory before you can attack the first theory. Now, I wish I could tell you this afternoon that I had an opposing theory. I cannot do that. All I'm saying is that myself, somebody called Norman Macbeth, who was a Harvard jurist, who, like myself, came to this later in life, said the same thing. It seems a bit feeble to say that even though my theory is a bit feeble, it'll have to do because nobody else can put up another one. I mean, that seems to be illogical, even though it coheres with the strange biological etiquette, which seems to be reigning in that discipline.
I just get the impression that scientists have become philosophically materialists. They're no longer pure scientists, but they're wedded to a materialist view. And in effect, it becomes anything but God. And so if this is the best we can do, as riddled with holes as it is, we have to stick together and push on this front.
Yes, I couldn't have put it better myself. I agree totally, yes. Mm-hmm.
So what do you account for in your own, I mean, being an agnostic over the years, being a member of the British Rationalist Association, it would seem to me you would have had similar predilections philosophically. What was it that suddenly made you decide to look at this in a more open-minded way and to leave your colleagues behind, at least most of them, I'm guessing?
Yes. I do have some reservations about the group of people I call doctrinaire rationalists, who simply the anything but God or superior force. I mean, I do dissent from that line. I suppose that my the freedom of retirement and being not beholden to anybody, to having a sort of second business career. I make myself sound a bit like Heinrich Schliemann. I'm not in that league, I can assure you. But, you know, I'm comfortably off. And, you know, I have the kind of repose to think honestly about things without pressures from outside. And I'm guessing, I mean, self-psychologizing is a little bit of a fool's game, and sometimes when it's difficult to interpret yourself. But I would imagine that was the additional factor of this particular decade of my existence, that I felt freedom to think honestly and clearly. And I felt myself going up against what I'd simply taken as read earlier on, you know, that it needed more unpacking. And that's what I've attempted to do.
Anybody who refers to Heinrich Schliemann is an instant friend of mine. I'd love to talk to you about and other crazy Germans of the 19th century, maybe in another conversation in the future, because I'm very interested in that. I read literally yesterday that archaeologists in Hisarlik, Troy, discovered what they actually believe could be the Trojan horse. That sounds preposterous to me. We've only got seconds left, but did you read that?
I haven't read it. I would be surprised. I would need some convincing.
When we come back, I'll let you answer that more fully. We're going to another break, but it has nothing to do with our subject, but so what?
Okay. You're on.
Folks, final segment. I'm talking to Neil Thomas, the author of a terrific new book. Not a big book. It's called Taking Leave of Darwin. Neil, I didn't mean to get you off on the subject of Schliemann and his sort of Trojan horse, but I'm interested in Odysseus's invention. It was his idea. The Trojan horse was his idea. And I literally read yesterday that that somebody thinks they found it. It seems preposterous to me. It would be made of wood and so on and so forth. So I didn't mean to get you off on that. I want to talk to you more about your book, unless you have something to say about the Trojan horse.
It would accord with Odysseus's reputation as being a tricksy kind of fellow, that he would, that you'd have that idea. What doesn't seem to me totally perspicuous is that I understood that when Schliemann excavated Troy, he went down too deep. He didn't actually hit his proper target. So where this horse is, I don't know, because I haven't seen what you've seen, but I will keep my eye out for that.
The whole thing's crazy, but we'll follow up on that just because it's
crazy, but interesting. Yeah.
Hoping to sell a few copies of your book because it was such a fun read for me. It's why I wanted to get you on here. The book is Taking Leave of Darwin. What made you think of writing an entire book on the subject? In other words, it's one thing to have some thoughts. It's another thing
yes.
to put your neck out.
Yes, I understand what you mean. What happened, I originally wrote an article which I submitted to a journal called The New Humanist in London. And they were interested, but in the end they decided not to publish it because they said, "Well, we've taken advice from scientific colleagues, and they say don't publish." Well, I can imagine, you know, if you apply to the Guild of Biologists who mark their own homework, yes, and they wouldn't take very kindly to this kind of argument. So, what happened was that I kept on being interested in the subject. I'm still interested in the subject. I'm coming to write a second book, which we can talk about some other time, perhaps. But I kept on working on it, and it sort of ballooned, and so it became from an article. It became a chapter, then two chapters, and so on. The rest is history. It came from that point.
Do you think that that there is an openness out there in the academy to rethinking Darwin fundamentally? Because you go back in the book and you talk about what some of his earlier critics
yes.
said. A lot of that was just dispensed with eventually, and then we've gotten onto this Darwinist juggernaut. Do you think
yeah.
that there is an opening in these days to rethink this or to be more critical of it?
I would very much doubt it, to be candid with you. I don't think that somebody in my position without biological credentials would be able to hack it, where people far more higher up in the biological hierarchy have written similar things before and have not been able to penetrate this sort of armor, this Darwinian armor that the biologists wear. I wish I could tell you otherwise, but that's what I think.
But you don't mind saying, so it strikes me that anytime someone is not in a discipline, they seem to have a freedom that those in the discipline don't have. In other words, those in the
yes.
discipline say, no one who is not a tenured biologist in the academy can write on this subject. And so in a way, people outside the field can think with the freedom, can think across disciplines. And so they bring a perspective to it that people deep in the field often don't have. David Berlinski is someone else who's written brilliantly on this. He's also an agnostic. And you, because you don't have, as you put it, any skin in the game, you can look at it more freely without fear of, you know, triggering your colleagues in the department, so to speak.
Oh, very much so. And one other thing I think is, I mean, I'm to some extent duplicating the point you've already made, but there's a great kind of disjunction between the biological orthodoxy and what philosophers who have analyzed this subject have come up with. Philosophers have tended to suggest that there is no basis. They've more or less suggested what I've suggested. There's a sort of legendary British philosopher called Mary Midgley, who was so dismissive of Richard Dawkins's conception about memes and so on, and much else besides, that legend has it that Richard Dawkins was impelled to turn down an invitation to appear with Mary Midgley on the same platform because he feared facing her over the breakfast table in that conference. I mean, that sounds a bit scurrilous. I mean it only as a humorous point. But the point is this, that there is a very radical disjunction between people like myself who look at it dispassionately, and people like philosophers, although I'm not a philosopher, I wouldn't claim to be a philosopher, I'm a literary historian, if anything, and the biological cadre who stick together and maintain the Darwinian party line.
Yeah. Well, again, I mentioned that David Berlinski, also Philip Johnson, he's a professor of law in California. I often think that people outside a discipline can see things more clearly and can simply think without fear. And that's what I think you've done in the book. It really is a terrific book. Your writing is what recommends it most highly, I think, that you write wonderfully. You almost write in an English accent, but not quite. Tell us, we've only got 30 seconds left. Tell us about the new book you're writing in just a few seconds.
Well, it's I've tended to try and drill down on some of the arguments and some of the themes that I've looked at, I'm playing with the title of Darwin's theory of evolution as a cosmogenic myth, which is a kind of homage to Michael Denton's book of 1985, which started off the.
Look, we'll have to have you back soon if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Folks, get a copy of Taking Leave of Darwin, a terrific read by Neil Thomas. Neil, thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's Elbin. I'm still back here in the New York City area, and you are still where? Somewhere?
I believe I'm in part of Connecticut, technically. But I was my dad wanted me to cut some stuff down, so I was able to play with the chainsaw. Was it yesterday or the day before? It was yesterday in the rain and the day before, just cutting down some stuff, taking care of business, and then the rains came, and it's still raining, of course. But that's nothing compared to what other people have gone through. There've been just a lot of stuff going on in the Northeast, but around other parts of the country, obviously in Tennessee, many people died in the flooding. It's just hard to imagine. I haven't been paying much attention.
Yeah. We didn't get it as bad as we were supposed to. I must say though, for the folks out there listening, I mean, it must be refreshing to think of you with a chainsaw, you know, working on your pecs I'm glad to hear that you were doing
that. Yeah, working on my pecs. That's the whole issue. Yeah. But listen, though, we should get serious here. We talk about the storm.
Yes.
I believe this was the storm when it began. It struck Haiti. And really, the people there were suffering before the storm hit. So I want to say, folks, this is something you can do. With all the bad news that's going on, you can do a good thing. It's a way of praising God and thanking God for everything that you have. There are children in places like Haiti, but specifically in Haiti. That's what we're focused on right now. Food for the Poor, they feed these kids that deal with malnutrition. It's an amazing thing that not far from our shores, we have people really suffering. The good news is we can do something about it with very little money. If you go to MetaxasTalk.com and click on the banner, you will see basically if you give monthly, you can do tremendous things for these kids. $37 feeds a kid for 6 months. So, you know, obviously per month, we're talking $2 a month. So if you give $10 a month, you can just do an amazing amount. Food for the Poor is one of these organizations we've worked with for a long time. They're very reputable. They stretch the American dollar tremendously far. $111 feeds three kids for 6 months. So please go to MetaxasTalk.com. Alvin, do we have some audio and do we have a phone number?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, they're just now reaching some of these isolated villages. And we have a report here from the BBC. You got to listen to this. You want to play that, James?
We've just got to a rural location. And what we're seeing here is utter devastation. Pretty much every single house has been totally destroyed. We just spoke to one woman who lives in that house there, and she says that her 15-year-old son, who was just about to finish school, was killed when he was trying to charge his phone. Devastating stories everywhere.
Wow, that's really something. But we can provide hope for these people. Let me give you the phone number, if I may. I've got it right here in front of me somewhere. Here it is, 844. 863-HOPE, 844-863-HOPE, or go to the banner at the very top of our page, click on that and give what you can, please.
844-863-HOPE. Folks, I just think it's important sometimes just to do something that's an unmitigated, unqualified good. There are people suffering. They were suffering before the storm. They will be suffering after all the details of the storm have been dealt with. They're in an extreme a situation of extreme poverty, malnutrition. No kid in this world should have to suffer from malnutrition. Please help. Go to MetaxasTalk.com or dial 1-8, what is it? 888?
844-863-HOPE.
844-863-HOPE. 844-863-HOPE. We need your help. We haven't hit our goal yet. 844-863-HOPE. Please do what you can. Tremendously good cause. God bless you as you give.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.